Welcome to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase, our monthly performing arts program devoted to Iowa's not-for-profit arts and cultural organizations. I'm Jacqueline Hallbloom. The artistic planets are aligning in October all over Iowa. We'll touch base with musicians gearing up for the Iowa Composers Forum's fall concerts featuring new music by Iowa composers. We'll anticipate the return of pianist and Iowa's sweetheart, Chelsea Wang, as she opens the Ames Town & Gown 2016-17 concert season, collaborating with internationally acclaimed violinist Ida Kafafian. We'll delve into the recently discovered enigmatic photography of Vivian Meyer, currently on display at the Des Moines Arts Center. We'll discover what one of the world's most beloved and famous sopranos, Renee Fleming, will be performing tonight at Hanter Auditorium. And we'll learn about Ballet Quad City's exciting 20th season. That's all ahead on Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase. Thanks for joining us.
One thing that people don't really understand is we do a lot of main stage performances. Last year we actually did 10 Nutcrackers. We tour across the entire state, but we do a tremendous amount of programming in the community. We have a program called Dance Me a Story, Exploring Literature Through Ballet, which just encourages people of all ages to pick up a book and read through the vehicle of dance. And at the end of June, we have done that program for 10,000 people.
Jody Cook, founding executive director of the Ballet Quad Cities. Ballet Quad Cities kicks off their 20th season this year with over 30 performances planned. The company is the longest-running professional ballet company in Iowa and Western Illinois. Plus, it is only one of 100 in the nation and the only one not founded by a professional dancer or choreographer. It's hard to believe now, but it all started when the two women who owned the ballet school Jody's daughter attended informed Jody that they were going bankrupt and would have to close. Jody, who was the mother of four, volunteered to run the school for 6 months, and the rest is history. One owner left and Jody bought her share of the school. During the entire process, Jody not only became the executive director, but also grew passionate about dance and became permanently hooked on ballet. Even though she didn't have a business plan to start with, her board was behind her 100%. She began by knocking on doors, and over its 20-year history, assembling a remarkable group of dancers, now under the direction of artistic director Courtney Lyon. Jody Cook.
20 years ago, I had $25,000 and one paid dancer and a dream in living color that there would be a resident professional ballet company in the Quad Cities. So we're starting our season with Dracula in October. We're bringing back our guest artist Domingo Rubio from Mexico, whom the fans absolutely adore. We'll move into Nutcracker, then we do Love Stories, which is a mixed rep, and we'll bring a lot of our old pieces back that have just been audience favorites. And then we close our season with the Wild Wild West, Aaron Copland's Rodeo and Billy the Kid.
And you are doing a couple of your performances with Orchestra Iowa.
That's correct. So Nutcracker and Wild Wild West will both have live music. We'll be at the Paramount Theater in Cedar Rapids and the Adler Theater in Davenport. And this year, right now, we have 12 dancers. We have 6 men. We have 6 women. And we probably will hire one more woman before we actually begin in September. The choreography this year will be done by our artistic director, Courtney Lyon, our resident choreographer, Deanna Carter, who lives in Iowa City, and then Margaret King, who is our ballet mistress.
And so how can folks get more details and information and all of that?
They can visit our website. We have a wonderful website. It's brand new, all sorts of information. Tickets are available actually to purchase on our website. They can call the office. There is Ticketmaster. And I would encourage everyone to become our Facebook friend because we put something up there almost every day.
And you also do a special concert in the spring, which is outdoors.
That is Ballet Under the Stars. It's always the first weekend in June, and that's our gift to the community. It's no admission charge, certainly is not free, but you don't have to buy a ticket. It's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday evening at 8 o'clock. It's outside in one of the most beautiful parks in our city, Rock Island, Illinois. Beautiful oak trees, stars, a breeze. It's a wonderful evening of dance. It's about an hour long.
So why is dance so important? And why did you dedicate your whole life to dance and to the Ballet Quad Cities?
Well, for me, I think that ballet is the perfect art form. It incorporates the music, it incorporates literature, the visual arts. I love visual arts. I design a lot of the costuming myself. So with the costuming and the backdrops, and of course now it's health and wellness. Dance is the perfect vehicle for almost any discipline, and it's what makes us human. Humanities are what makes every single one of us human. Many times I get into conversations with people and funders now because, you know, it's so important for what's going on in our world. People are concerned that you have a meal to eat, let alone the extras, which people consider the arts to be the extras. But I think that you need to feed your soul just like you need to feed your body, and that's what we do. We feed everyone's soul from 3 to 90. We love to feed people through the vehicle of dance.
Jody Cook, founding executive director of Ballet Quad Cities. The 20th anniversary season for Ballet Quad Cities starts on October 21st and 22nd at Moline's Scottish Rite Cathedral, presenting their group's Everlasting Tale of Dracula. For exact details about their artistic season, performance dates, community outreach, and how to get tickets, please see their website at balletquadcities.com. Jody says Ballet Quad Cities was meant to be, and after you see their list of active partners, their artistic and professional growth, and their amazing, talented troupe of dancers, you know that she is right. Just ahead, we'll meet with musicians sharing details about the Iowa Composers Forum's upcoming fall concerts. We'll enjoy learning about an exciting performance with Iowa's own Chelsea Wang. We'll chat with one of the most beloved and beautiful voices in the world, globally celebrated soprano Renee Fleming. And we'll explore the unusual circumstances behind the Des Moines Arts Center's exhibit called Vivian Meyer Through a Critical Lens. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Arts Showcase. The late street photographer Vivian Meyer has been called remarkable and fascinating. The more you learn about her anonymity, the more you think, like Alice in Wonderland, that Vivian's life and work is curiouser and curiouser. The Des Moines Arts Center's senior curator, Allison Ferris.
She has a fascinating story. She, in and of herself, she was a nanny, basically a caretaker, a domestic servant all of her life, but she also always carried a camera with her. In fact, many people remember and say, oh, she always had a camera around her neck. So despite the fact that she was always very busy looking after other people, she always seemed to find the time to make photographs, whether it was of her charges or when she was out on the street.
She had sort of an interesting upbringing, and she was a very unusual person.
That's what it sounds like. We only know from people who have known her, because no one, especially in the art world, ever met her while she was alive. She made all these photographs, but I guess there's a question about whether or not she ever intended for them to be seen. They were discovered by a couple of people, namely John Maloof. He's the person we are borrowing the photographs from. He found them in a storage locker in Chicago at an auction. She apparently had gotten ill and had gotten behind on her bills and didn't pay the rent on her storage unit. So as a result, they basically started auctioning off the materials that were in various storage lockers, including hers. And he happened to be writing and researching a book on Chicago architecture and took a couple of looks at some of the negatives and thought that they might be helpful for his book. That's why he bidded on them. And then when he started looking a little bit more closely, he realized that he might have something a little bit more on his hands than just architectural photography of Chicago in the 50s.
A treasure trove of negatives. She left a huge amount of film.
There are 200,000 negatives that she made, which is an extraordinary amount of photographs. I mean, even the best-known famous photographers haven't made that much work. It really is indeed astonishing. And we're only at the beginning of understanding what the whole archive actually consists of, what all of that is.
And they think that she may have learned about photography from a professional photographer. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, that's still a little murky. She and her mother lived with a professional photographer when she was growing up, so that this woman could have been an influence on her. But Vivian was largely self-taught, which was not unusual for the time. Photography was something that was really intriguing to lots and lots of people. And just as Vivian was getting interested in photography, a couple of institutions started showing photography, namely the Museum of Modern Art and the Art Institute of Chicago. And they did find photo books in her possessions when they found the lockers and what have you. So she did go to museums and look at photography. So she wasn't a naive artist. She knew what was going on out there.
Well, tell us about her photos and what's so powerful about them.
First of all, she had a very practiced eye. I mean, she was able to frame her photographs in a really beautiful way. She seemed to just kind of encapsulate these stories in one frame of her photograph. Or when she's not taking photographs of a scene, she does almost portraiture like work out on the street. And the people that she photographs are fascinating people. There's a psychology there that she seems to eke out of just one shot or one portrayal of an individual person. And people described her as sort of a grumpy, closed kind of person, you know, just a curmudgeonly-like person. But I don't think her photographs show that aspect of her at all. In fact, I think they really show her as being interested in and embracing humanity in a very positive way. And I think that's what is really attractive to people about her photographs, whether they know that or not. I think, ultimately, there's this hope in humanity, which is, I think, a very positive thing to see these days, especially.
So you have an amazing amount of things that you are going to be doing in conjunction with this exhibit of Vivian Meyer. So tell us about some of the other things that you're going to be presenting at the Des Moines Art Center.
We are going to be bringing in Professor John Tagg. He's a distinguished professor of art history at Binghamton University in New York. And we actually asked him to look at Vivian's work and contextualize it in the history of photography. His lecture is called The Camera and the Street. And he is a brilliant professor and thinker about photography. He has been working on photography since the late 1970s and was one of the first theorists of photography, so to speak. So the fact that he is actually writing a talk specifically about Vivian Meyer for our audience is going to be a special event indeed. And that is going to be on Thursday, October 20th at 6:30. And then we're also going to be showing the documentary called Finding Vivian Meyer. We're showing that at the Arts Center three times, October 23rd at 1:30, November 13th at 1:30, January 8th at 1:30. They're all Sunday afternoons. And it should be fun to talk with folks about Vivian Meyer following the film. So we hope all your listeners will join us.
And you're also digging into the Des Moines Art Center's permanent collection and doing a Whose Streets show as well.
Yes, the city and the city streets have been subject of interest by modern artists since the late 1800s, if not even before. So we have prints, we have photographs and paintings all depicting the street at different times, expressing these different ways that the street has been understood in 20th century art.
And the community photography showcase, that sounds like so much fun.
We are doing a call for entries, and we are asking people to submit their street photography, and the show will be curated, and the images that will be on view will be juried, and the celebration for this exhibition will be held on Thursday, December 15th from 5 to 7. So that'll be fun to see what our neighbors come up with in terms of their visions of the street and street photography right now. And we're hoping that lots of people come and get hooked on Vivian Meyer's work just like we have.
The Des Moines Arts Center's senior curator, Allison Ferris. DesMoinesArtsCenter.org will give you all the details and events on the Vivian Meyer Through a Critical Lens exhibition, along with the multitude of other activities and exhibitions at the Art Center. Just ahead, we'll get the inside scoop on the Ames Town & Gown season opener starring a former Iowan. We'll learn how being an opera diva isn't all about glamour. And we'll hear from a quartet of musicians about their upcoming fall concert, featuring music by composers with an Iowa connection. This is the Iowa Art Showcase on Iowa Public Radio.
As somebody who has sort of moved back to the area very recently, it's really exciting to be back in this part of the country. There's an appreciation for the arts and for music and for sort of advanced arts and even for new music that is pretty rare. I mean, there are urban areas that are sort of hotbeds of experimentation, but it's appreciation of music and appreciation of art is such a deep part of the culture around here. It's a big part of actually why I chose to come back here. So it's really exciting to think that we can be producing new music and really finding receptive audiences for it here.
And the Iowa Composers Forum is a long-standing organization that has supported and encouraged composers and musicians. And I think it's just a wonderful organization that brings musicians and composers with Iowa connections to new audiences across the state. So I'd encourage people to come hear some music by local performers and by local composers.
Composer and pianist Ben Hippen and oboist Heather Armstrong. Ben and Heather will be joined by flutist Carol Hester and cellist Craig Holtgren. Together, they will perform a concert of work submitted by members of the Iowa Composers Forum to be performed in an all-Iowa or Iowa-related fall concert. The new music chamber concert, organized by composer, Luther professor, and chair of the Iowa Composers Forum, Brooke Joyce, will include trios, duos, and a couple of solo pieces in an array of styles. Flutist Carol Hester.
I teach flute here at Luther, and I've taught here for 26 years. I grew up in Alabama and did my graduate work at Florida State in Tallahassee, Florida, and this is my first job interview and turned into a great location for me.
I'm Heather Armstrong. I teach oboe and music theory at Luther College. I've been here 10 years and I also play principal oboe in the Waterloo Cedar Falls Symphony. And a couple years ago, I played a concerto for oboe and orchestra that Brooke wrote for me.
I'm Ben Hippen, composer. I grew up in Decorah, actually, and just moved back here about 6 months ago.
You have a rather unusual past.
I took the scenic route getting here, yeah. In my other life, I'm an emergency physician.
And you got into this role in Africa?
That's right. In the 90s, I spent some time in Africa and basically had some pretty dramatic experiences there that changed my life.
And your music?
I've been playing music since I was young, been writing since I was in junior high, and it really feels good to be getting back to it full time.
I'm Craig Holgren. I'm a cellist. I have recently relocated back to Iowa after many years playing down in Alabama. I am from Iowa originally, from Davenport, and a graduate of the University of Iowa and Indiana University as well.
And what brings you back to Iowa?
Family and the great country of Decorah, and I finally figured out a way to support myself and play new music, and so I didn't have to actually always be in my orchestra job.
And you did a lot with new music and with youth when you were in Alabama.
Yeah, you know, Birmingham is a kind of city where you sort of have to build it yourself. And culturally, you know, there was a lot to be done. And so I did a lot of organizational work. I'm a founding member of the Scrollworks program, which provides inexpensive music instruction to inner city youth.
And you have performed a lot of new music, and you even have performed like on an electronic cello?
Yes, I've been active in new music for 27 years or so, and I have all sorts of varieties of applications for the instrument, and many of that includes amplification, works for signal processing, or works with electronics. And then I've gone so far, and I've owned it now for 17 years, I have an electric cello, the E-cello made by Tucker Barrett in Vermont, and it's basically an instrument without a body. It's got shoulders and the strings and the fingerboard and the neck and everything you need to play the instrument properly, but it has no sounding acoustic bass, and it's a very unusual looking instrument. So yes, I play that, and I also have a couple of very nice acoustic cellos as well. But the electric instrument, you know, is the sign of the times. Everybody recognizes it after having seen electric guitars so much.
The program starts with two different trios for flute, oboe, and cello. Craig Holtgren talks about the first trio on the Iowa Composer Forum's fall concert.
Randy Wells wrote this trio. The title of it is 1045, Augustine Trebuchon. And what this is a reference to is the armistice time at the conclusion of World War I. And as the papers were being signed for the cessation of war, the field commanders on site in the trenches ordered all-out shelling and killing to carry on in case the agreement was not signed and ratified. And what ended up happening, some commanders would throw out just loads of ammunition and bombs, and some 2,700 men perished on the day the armistice was signed. One of the last was this Frenchman, Augustine Trebuchon, and this was at 10:45, the moment it was signed. And the piece is dark. It's slow. It's turgid. It's like being in the mud in the trenches. It's very dissonant. It takes its aesthetic from that time when things were falling apart in a romantic tradition, and dissonance was the norm. And it's a very dark, disturbing work.
Composer Ben Hippen discusses why he transcribed his work.
The piece is called Virunga. It's from an album that I released earlier this year of piano music. Virunga is a national park in Africa. It's near a place where I did a research project in my medical days. It has just a phenomenally interesting story, hugely significant part of that region of Africa, very colorful, inspirational, and tragic story. So that's sort of the issues that I tried to grapple with this music. So the original instrumentation was solo piano. It was originally written for a benefit fundraiser for a nonprofit that I'm associated with called Care Under Fire, which raises funds for work there. So when I moved back to Iowa, I joined the Iowa Composers Forum, which is very exciting. And I got the notice that there was a very talented trio of players who are going to be available for this. So I arranged music from the album for this trio.
And is this an album available?
It is. It's available on Spotify, iTunes, Amazon, anywhere that fine music streams.
Carol Hester discloses why having access to the composer has its perks.
Well, since this piece was originally written for piano, we have that opportunity to bring our colors into his previous composition that he's reworked for us. And so that offers some challenges. And we were just talking to him today about a certain section where it's hard for the flutist and the oboist to find a place to breathe, which is not a challenge that you would have as a pianist in that certain pattern. So again, that was great. We right away went to him and asked, okay, what do we do in this section? And where is it okay if we create our own space to breathe? But he says, I'll get back with you on that. So I love that. So I'll look forward to what he sends us. And yesterday was our first time to rehearse, but there were some really beautiful colors where he has the flute and oboe really high and the cello lower, some really soft. So I'm interested and looking forward to what happens as we work on this more, how those colors evolve.
With modern music, do you find that composers like to do non-traditional things with the instruments and how you perform on them?
You know, I find that they like to experiment with colors and with rhythmic patterns. And as a performer, you know, I'm trying to think, what are they hoping to achieve with this? What's their purpose? So that it's not just a gimmick, but it's something that they're really integrating into the music and what they're trying to express. So it's great to be able to play music by living composers, because if you have a question, you can ask, or, you know, what is it that, what kind of sound, what kind of color are you really wanting? And so you find that when you're doing new music that there's so much variety and challenges for the performer sometimes in extended techniques, or, you know, it's so fresh and so new. And a lot of times composers will say, well, I don't know, what would you like to do here? So there's a lot of back and forth between the performer and the composer. And that's one of the really great things about performing and working with composers of new music.
Now, you are performing a solo work as well for alto flute. So tell us about that and the composer.
Yes, it's a recent composition that Brooke Joyce wrote for a flutist who commissioned it. Her name is Lisa Bost. And it's based on a place in Scotland, Rubna Hoonish, I believe. It's on the northern tip of the Isle of Skye. I've never been there, but Brooke visited there and fell in love with the place. And it's a two-part work. The first part is based on Strasby, I believe it's called, which is a very regal part of the piece, and that is followed immediately by a jig. And so I'm finding it challenging to, the alto flute, of course, is bigger, and the keys are heavier, and how do I create this jig-like character on an instrument that usually you hear play warm, low notes and oftentimes very slow and melodic. But I love working on it. Yeah, it's been a great challenge. So I'm looking forward to living with that piece for a while.
Heather Armstrong and Craig Hultgren continue talking about the other works they will perform on the Iowa Composers Forum's fall concert.
I'll be performing a solo oboe piece on the program by Elaine Erickson. The title of the piece is Two Dances, one of which is Secret Garden, and the other is Night Dance. The first is very lyrical and expressive and includes some humming that goes along with the oboe part, and Craig will be putting his cello down and humming along with that a couple points in the first movement. And the Night Dance is much more rhythmic and angular, and there's an optional drum part, which Craig is also going to play. So it is a piece that has a lot of nice contrasts in it, and it's been fun to work on that. The faster movement has a lot of the oboe's lowest note, which is a low B flat, a note that doesn't come out very easily on the oboe. So it's been kind of fun to work on trying to get that to respond in such a rhythmic, angular, fast kind of tempo. And the flute and oboe duet, as an example of something Carol was talking about with some extended techniques, has one of the movements is called Canyon del Muerto, Mummy Cave. And the piece uses a lot of trills that are not whole steps or half steps, but more like quarter tone trills. And so it gives a very eerie kind of effect to the piece, I think helps bring out kind of the mood maybe that Greg Steinke, who is the composer, was going after in that piece. So that would be an example of an extended technique in that flute and oboe duet.
And we're doing another of Greg's image music, both the oboe and flute work, along with his Van Gogh vignettes, which is for flute and cello, are based on visual images. For the Van Gogh, it's based on, of course, Van Gogh's paintings. And we'll be playing two of those. One is the Potato Eaters, and the other is Seascape near the Saint-Maurice-de-la-Mer. And those are, the second one especially, is a more of the latter-day Van Gogh that we recognize. Even the flute and oboe duet is based on photography from these sites out in New Mexico.
Steinke is an oboist himself, so did he add some of these extra terrestrial things, these different things in your part because he knows what the oboe can do?
I haven't met Greg or corresponded with him, but there are a lot of notations in the score that are clearly based on someone who has a lot of experience with the oboe and the instrument and things that you would not normally find a composer writing into a score. So it's been kind of fun to notice those along the way, and they've been, for the most part, really helpful. So I'm enjoying it so far.
Heather Armstrong, Craig Hultgren, Carol Hester, and Ben Hippen talking about the two Iowa Composers Fall Forum concerts. The first program on Thursday evening, October 13th at 7 p.m. will be held in the intimate front parlor music room of the Porter House Museum in Decorah. The second concert will be given at 3 on Sunday afternoon, October 16th at Davenport's Figge Art Museum. For more information, please see iowacomposers.org. Also, the Red Cedar Chamber Music will present a concert tonight at 7 at the First Presbyterian Church in Cedar Rapids. Details at redcedar.org. Don't go away. You'll learn about Miss Fleming's performance mantra. And you'll also hear how violinist extraordinaire Ida Kafafian and Iowa's own Chelsea Wang were chosen to showcase the opening Town and Gown concert in Ames. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Arts Showcase.
I'm just really excited. This is the first major performance that I'm giving in my home state in a while, so it really means a lot to me to be sharing my music making back home. And I was invited by Paula to perform for the Ames Town and Gown annual musicale when I was still in high school. And so being able to come back and play for the opening concert for the new season is something that's very meaningful to me. I'm so grateful to Paula for making this possible. And actually, I think one of the reasons why this was able to come about is because Ida is a close childhood friend, I think, to Paula. And this was something that I discovered once I came to Curtis and got to know Miss Kavafian. And we thought, wow, what a small world. And the fact that we are able to reunite like this through a performance back home in Iowa is very special. Plus, Ida Kavafian, she's amazing. I met Miss Kavafian when I came to Curtis in 2012, and I've just been coached by her through playing chamber music with her students, and she's an incredible musician, and she's really like one of a kind, and she never fails to amaze me with her passion and her level of energy is always through the roof, and she's just so spunky all the time, and I think it's a great honor for me to be performing with her.
Guest pianist and Iowa native Chelsea Wang. Miss Wang will be joining Ida Kafafian on ISU's Martha Ellen Tai Recital Hall stage for the opening concert of the Ames Town and Gown concert season. Paula Forrest serves as the artistic director of the Ames Town and Gown series and was instrumental in arranging the opening concert with Miss Kafafian and also Miss Wang. Chelsea talks about her background.
I was actually born in Ames, where I will be performing, and then I lived the rest of my life in West Des Moines. And I started piano around age 4 and violin around age 7.
Now, you made your orchestral debut when you were 6. Tell us about that.
For a very short while, my family lived in Las Vegas, Nevada. And so it was there where I did my first orchestral debut. I was a part of a very small competition, and I won a prize, and so I was able to perform with the orchestra. I played a Haydn concerto.
Tell us about some of the Iowa teachers you've had, and then let's talk about some of the places you've gone to school and performed.
In Iowa, I studied with Chaoling Lin at Drake University. She's retired now. I studied with her for a few years, and then I went on to study with Ksenia Nosikova at the University of Iowa. And I studied with her all the way up until I graduated from high school and then came to Curtis.
And you also were featured on From the Top.
Yes, I was 13 or 12, somewhere around there, and they had a show in Des Moines. And so I was on that show, and it was a great time. Yeah, From the Top is really special.
Tell us about some of the other wonderful experiences that you've had and some of the people you've played with. And now that you're Curtis, tell us a little bit about this whole progression.
First of all, it's a dream come true for me to be at such an amazing institution. Curtis is just one of the best schools in the world, and it's just an honor for me to be here. And I've been here for 5 years. This is my final year. And I've learned so much while being here. I feel like it's given me so many experiences that I never would have imagined I could have. Just from working with legendary musicians to things like getting free tickets to see the Philadelphia Orchestra. And I learned so much through performing and working with the Curtis faculty members here, all of the teachers. I've been able to work with Peter Wiley, performing the Shostakovich Piano Quintet. I've been able to perform the Brahms Piano Quartet in G minor with our school's president and amazing violist, Roberto Diaz. And now that I'm getting to perform a recital with Ida Kavafian is something that I could only previously dream about. So I'm very excited.
Miss Wang discusses the work she'll be performing with Miss Kavafian on their October 15th concert.
Ms. Kavafian and I are going to be playing a program consisting of Mozart, Messiaen, Mendelssohn, and Strauss. And we are playing the Mozart G major sonata, K301. And I think it's a cult favorite to many people. It's such a sweet piece, and it's two movements. And it's a piece that Mozart wrote when he was a child, because he was just such a prodigy. Ida and I actually have played this piece together before at her festival, Music at Angel Fire, and we both loved it so much that we wanted to play it again, so we put it on this program.
And it's quite an exciting piece, particularly in the coda at the end.
The interesting part about this piece is that both violin and piano parts are so equally predominant when it comes to who has the theme and who is accompanimental. And so it always switches between the two of us. And so it makes it really interesting as a listener to follow the lines and the phrases. And it's a very sweet piece, and it's not super long, but it's a great concert starter.
Tell us about the next work. And this work was just recently discovered, not too long ago.
Yes, this piece is one that is not so often played. And it was discovered and published posthumously. His widowed wife was able to offer it to the public. And this piece is incredibly rich in color and very beautiful. And there are a lot of distinct qualities of Messiaen that you just hear throughout the piece. And there's a lot of similarities between other pieces that he wrote, like his Quartet for the End of Time, and also some of his other piano pieces, like the Opus 1 Prelude. There's a lot of resemblances between them.
Well, this was like a real treasure of Messiaen's that was discovered, and he had composed this for his first wife, so it was a special piece for him as well.
Yes, too bad that it's not so often played, but hopefully more people will get to know how special of a piece it is.
Tell us how you approach this piece and try to bring out the qualities of Messiaen in it.
Well, first of all, Messiaen had synesthesia, and he could see colors so vividly through the music and harmonies that he composed and wrote. And he also loved nature so much, and so much of his music was just about creating sounds of nature and birds or the abyss or rainbows or just any possible feeling or image that he could think of. And so this piece, similarly to a lot of his other works, is very colorful and imaginative, and you hear a lot of what he wants to convey.
Now you are going to be performing as solo on this recital as well. Tell us about this work and why you selected it.
Yes, I will be playing Mendelssohn's F-sharp minor sonata. It's nicknamed the Scottish Fantasy because it was actually written around the time that Mendelssohn, among other German composers at the time, was really fascinated by Scotland and their culture and folk music, history, everything. And this piece is super lovely. It's a piece that I've always wanted to play for quite some time. And Mendelssohn is so special and dear to me, so I decided to pick this piece. It's a piano sonata, basically, / fantasy, and it's in three movements, and all of them are so incredibly different. And the piece is somewhat of a paradox because it's named fantasy, but it's really in the form of a sonata, kind of. And Mendelssohn really plays around with the two forms and mixing the characteristics together. It's really a masterpiece. And I feel like a lot of it is very orchestral, and also some parts of it are very intimate, like string quartet sounding. And then there's also parts that feel very operatic. Just feel like it has so many great qualities, and it's very unique in its own way. And also, it's very structured. Whenever he has the fantasia-like sections, they're kind of like bridge material between the actual sonata sections that are much more serious and down-to-earth, as opposed to the fantasy quality in the fantasy sections where it's more dreamy and more extraterrestrial in a way. I love all of it, and it just gets more and more exciting. The work starts slow, and then it becomes moderately fast, and then it becomes presto. And so it just keeps building up, and so the excitement level keeps getting bigger and bigger. I love every part of it, and it's a rare gem that is not so often played, and I wanted to present it.
Tell us about this last work on the program, and this is a major tour de force work for both musicians.
Yes, this piece is a giant for sure. It's one of my favorites, and I think it's also one of Ms. Kavafian's favorite pieces as well, and she plays this piece amazingly. So it's a real joy and treat to be performing this piece with her. It's so beautiful and elegant, majestic, and typical of Strauss's writing. It's very lyrical and just so melodious, and it flows so well, and I mean, not to mention that technically, it's super challenging. It's a workout for both of us. By the end, we're just always panting after rehearsals, and but it's worth it all.
He wrote this sort of at the same time that he was writing Don Juan, and he was also courting and falling in love with his wife at the same time.
Yes, I was also wanting to mention that this piece is so incredibly romantic. You feel the love and the passion, and it can be quite overwhelming when we play, and the second movement is titled Improvisation, so it does feel very free and improvisatory, and there's a lot of rubato and time taken just to make the phrases extra beautiful. And it's a beautiful movement. And it's a great contrast between the first and the third movements, which are so majestic and epic in a way.
And in the third movement, the piano has a brief solo part before the allegro section starts.
Yes, it's kind of like a concerto cadenza in a way. It's a very flashy piano part for sure, but it's very fun to play. And I'm so excited and honored to be performing with Mr. Rafian. And again, I'm so grateful to Paula Forrest for making this happen. Really appreciate it.
Guest pianist and Iowa native Chelsea Wang will appear along with guest concert violinist Miss Ida Kafafian on the opening program of the Ames Town and Gown 67th Season Concert. The program will be held on October 15th at 7:30 p.m. at ISU's Martha Ellen Tye Recital Hall. Immediate action is suggested for concert tickets. For more details and information, please consult their website at amestownandgown.org. Don't go away. We're heading to Hancher's new auditorium to hear about this evening's concert with one of the world's finest singers. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase. Tonight, Iowans have the opportunity to hear in concert internationally renowned four-time Grammy Award-winning soprano and recipient of the 2012 National Medal of Arts, Miss Renee Fleming. Iowa Public Radio caught up with Miss Fleming in Boston last weekend, where she was performing a concert setting of DeRozan Cavalier with an international cast along with the Boston Symphony Orchestra. She was performing one of her signature roles of the Marshalin.
That's my favorite role. She is the most interesting, complex of the characters that I've sung. And as being a woman who has her own demons and lives in a time when she is, albeit so talented, it doesn't have very much power. And it's fascinating, actually. It's a great part.
Now, you're also, in May of next year, going to be performing this at the Met. Tell us about that.
Yes, this will be a new production by Robert Carson, who I've worked with a lot, mostly in Paris, and Alina Garancha. It's a fantastic cast, and I think Aaron Morley, who's also singing tonight. And I'm sure it will, you know, be a memorable new production for this opera.
Well, we're really excited in Iowa because it's also part of the HD series, so we'll get to see it as well.
Oh, fantastic. Wonderful.
We're really looking forward to that. In a recent article in the Washington Post, they talked about the HD transmissions, and some people are saying that this cuts opera attendance in live performances. What is your opinion about that?
You know, I think it's possible that there are people who develop a preference for the HD broadcast. It's easy, it's inexpensive, you can have popcorn. You know. But, you know, on the other hand, there a lot of people who go to them seem to already be people who enjoy the opera, and the hope is that other people will come and try it out in this easy environment that they're already familiar with, and then go and hopefully support local opera companies. But, you know, I don't think there's an easy way to know, and it may be that over time it builds the audience.
Well, you have been on both sides of the performances, not only appearing in the opera itself, but also as being one of the hosts or hostesses of the opera, which I think is just brilliant.
Oh, I really love doing it. And as I travel the world, I go to a lot of unusual places. I mean, when I was in New Zealand last year, for instance, I had an already made audience, and not just for my recordings, but for these HD broadcasts. So people are predisposed to liking you because they have a sense of your personality from these broadcast. So it's been really helpful for us as well.
You are so charming, and you really make getting to meet these singers and the opera is so approachable. It's just brilliant and it's wonderful.
Well, you know, I think it's something that everyone should experience and decide for themselves whether they like it or not. And there are a lot of people who don't go because they're, you know, anxious about the fact that they might not understand it. They're not sure what to wear. And it's something that I think, you know, the exposure is the key thing. And that's what I try to emphasize.
80% of your life is on the road. And how do you maintain the schedule? And you must have a closet the size of Grand Central Station, because every picture I see you in a new dazzling outfit.
That's a high maintenance part of my job, is trying to stay in gowns, no question. And it's definite work, but it's worth it.
So do you have help? Do you have someone who goes out and scopes out all these dresses and helps you pack and
do
all this?
Well, I work with certain designers. I've worked with a stylist for many years who's also a friend who's been fabulous. And by hook or by crook, we sort of pull it together. But, you know, I have already this rather extraordinary collection of couture gowns that I think is unique in the opera world, even from all of the famous singers I know from the last century. You know, I have them sort of in boxes and closets all over my apartment. I've been trying to figure out what to do with it all. So, you know, all the way around, it's a high maintenance part of my job.
Well, you always look smashing, so that's the main thing. And you always look beautiful when you're out and about. But just keeping that up, as well as you say you like to lead a normal life, but what is a normal life for you?
That's a good question. You know, the norm for me is pack, travel, sing. You know, that's my routine. And those of us who do it over time, that becomes comfortable. You know, it's kind of grueling, but it's also really wonderful. And it was a much greater challenge when my children were home. But now that they are young adults, it's a little bit easier.
America does have all these wonderful opera singers, but a lot of them aren't able to get work in the United States. So what do you recommend to these singers? Do you tell them to go to Europe to try to establish a career? And then is it hard for them to come back to America and continue singing?
Actually, that used to be the route. When I started singing, that was the tail end of that period of needing to start in Europe. And since then, there are so many companies in the U.S. that most Americans stay closer to home.
So,
I mean, I think studying abroad is brilliant because, you know, the addition of other foreign languages, it makes you into a much better artist. You know, I rarely in my career have ever sung opera in English. So the more familiar I am with the foreign languages, the better. I mean, I had a Fulbright scholarship, which was enormously helpful.
And you spent some time in Germany with that scholarship?
That's right, in Frankfurt, a year.
And then recently you just received from the German government the Cross of the Order.
Right, yes. Yes, that with the Legion of Honor in France. It's really thrilling.
Recently you became the creative consultant with the Lyric Opera of Chicago, and things have changed since you've been on board. Tell us a little bit about what you see for them and what you're trying to incorporate.
Well, my real interest is in audience development. So I was able, through working with Second City, not only develop a Second City Guide to the Opera, which was a big hit, but Second City, as a result, has developed a whole arm of presentation around the arts. They have a symphony program. They had now, we're premiering also this fall, a program about the Ring cycle. And they have a whole new cultural arm. And, you know, that came about because I actually went to one of their shows. And the young music director there played a clip from one of my CDs for one of the skits. And then suddenly everything falls into place. So that, also the Rodgers and Hammerstein musical series that we've had going. And Chicago Voices is what's happening this year. So this is drawing attention and really celebrating the tapestry of vocal arts in Chicago, both historically and now, with a big gala in February and a lot of other programming. So I've loved my work there, but now I'm also at the Kennedy Center now.
Obviously, you're so successful, they want to take some of your advice. So it sounds like you're kind of tapping into community connections then.
Right, exactly. And it's really exciting for me to give back in this way. It's a creative outlet for me. It's also a way of connecting with people and sharing all of the experience that I've had over the years.
So what about like these smaller opera companies that are popping up, and some in larger cities and some in smaller cities? Do you think that this provides more opportunities?
I really love the up-and-coming and more flexible small companies. One of the ones that I'm an advisor for is Beth Morrison Projects and the Prototype Festival in New York. She only produces new works, and that really revitalizes the art form. They're small, it's intimate, it's social. You know, everything about it is, as far as I'm concerned, the way forward.
And you are a big proponent of new music.
Definitely. I really love it, and I've performed a lot of it in my career, and I'm premiering a piece in November, actually, composed by Kevin Putz, Pulitzer Prize-winning composer who wrote Silent Night, the opera, and these are orchestral settings of some letters of Georgia O'Keeffe, and it is so beautiful. I think people will love it, and I think it will join the repertoire.
And where did you say you were performing that?
So the premiere is at the Eastman School of Music in Rochester, New York. They commissioned the work because Kevin and I are both graduates. And the second performance 2 days later is in Lincoln Center in New York.
Now, is there a role that you haven't sung yet that you always wish you could have sung?
Oh, gosh, yeah. I am a lyric soprano, so I would have loved to have sung all the great Puccini Spinto roles, or, you know, Wagner, or any of the bigger repertoire, but it didn't suit me. And frankly, I've had such a broad amount of repertoire and 54 roles that I can't complain.
Well, you came to Iowa before and you performed at Hanscher, and you sang works of Purcell and Handel and George Crumb and Schumann. Tell us about who you're bringing with you as your pianist and what you're going to be singing at Hanscher on October 8th when you come to perform.
It's an eclectic program. I have, starting with a couple of French arias and songs, and then the Schumann Frauen, Liebe und Leben, which is really one of the standard and greatest song cycles ever composed. And then I'll do Italian songs and arias and a couple of Spanish pieces and selections from The King and I. So there's something for everyone, I hope.
I think there is something for everyone. And tell us about your pianist. You have worked with him for some time as well.
Yes, Harpeth Ho is a brilliant partner for song recitals. I studied with him, actually, when I had the Fulbright Scholarship. And at the time, he was playing for Fischer Dieskau and really great, great singers as a very young pianist. And now we are friends, and he is actually also the director of one of the great conservatories in Germany. So he's had quite an auspicious career, and we're looking forward to this tour.
Well, we're looking forward to having you in Iowa. And you know, Hanscher, this is a brand new building. You're getting to break it in a little bit. So this is wonderful just to have you in the state and performing in this new facility.
Thank you so much. And I'm looking forward to coming back to Iowa again, because my real joy is in the rapport and relationship I can build with audiences. That is what I love most about what I do now. And every time I return, it's another opportunity to get to know everyone a little bit better.
Internationally renowned soprano, Miss Renee Fleming. Miss Fleming is performing tonight at Hanscher Auditorium starting at 7:30. For more details, go to hanscher.uiowa.edu. For more information about Miss Fleming and her amazing accomplishments and performing schedule, see reneefleming.com. Today's Iowa Arts Showcase broadcast is a production of Iowa Public Radio. Program thanks for this show goes to Renee Fleming, Jody Cook, Allison Ferris, Chelsea Wang, Carol Hester, Heather Armstrong, Ben Hippen, and Craig Holtgren. Production thanks goes to Iowa Public Radio's Tony Daner. Production assistance goes to IPR's John Pemble and Phil Moss. Program research was provided by Rachel Berenger. I'm Jacqueline Hallbloom. Thanks for listening. For more information on Iowa Public Radio's programming schedule and Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase, please visit our website at iowapublicradio.org.